listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2013 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud.
I am Maureen Moore, the Associate Director of the Aloud series of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. The style known as mid-century modern is all around us, in downtown buildings, in home interiors throughout the city, in vintage shops in Silver Lake. Maynard L. Parker, one of America's most prolific commercial photographers, was the one who embraced California as the visual epicenter of that phenomenon. As Jenny Watts writes in one of the chapters of this stunning new book about Parker, Modern Photography and the American Dream, his photographs crooked a metaphorical finger and beckoned viewers to come on in, take a seat, have a taste, and buy. The pantries looked good, the laundry rooms looked good, the bathrooms looked good. The backyard furniture looked good. This was photography that seduced Americans into a new consumer age. Tonight we've gathered a distinguished panel to set Maynard L. Parker's photography against the backdrop of the nation's demographic transitions after World War II, its Cold War anxieties and aspirations. Joining us in the discussion are Jennifer Watts, the curator of photographs at the Huntington, where her exhibitions, research, and writing has primarily focused on the photography of California and the American West. She has co-authored several books and is the curator of the recent and very powerful Huntington exhibition, A Strange and Fearful Interest, Death, Mourning, and Memory in the American Civil War. She's also the editor of Maynard L. Parker, Modern Photography and the American Dream. Christopher Hawthorne is architecture critic for the Los Angeles Times. His work has also appeared in The New Yorker, The Washington Post, Metropolis, Architectural Record, among many other publications. He is author, along with Elena Stang, of The Greenhouse, New Directions in Sustainable Agriculture. DJ Waldie is the author of books, essays, and blogs about Los Angeles and Southern California. He's a contributing writer at Los Angeles Magazine and a contributing editor for the Los Angeles Times. He is widely known for his award-winning memoir, Holy Land. His most recent book is House, in collaboration with Diane Keaton. So please help me give a warm welcome to tonight's panelists for Aloud at the LA Public Library.
Well, I have the privilege tonight to begin a conversation between two of the principal authors of Maynard L. Parker, Modern Photography and the American Dream. As you've heard in introduction, Jenny Watts, who is also the book's editor and I would say the book's impresario, and Christopher Hawthorne, whom you also know as Los Angeles Times architecture critic. Both Jenny and Christopher have put together some images from the book as illustrations to their remarks, but also to show you just how beautiful Maynard L. Parker's photographs can be. And I'm going to start with Jenny. Jenny, it might be best if you gave us kind of a sketch of Maynard L. Parker's life and his working practice and show us some pictures of that, too.
Okay, sure. I'm happy to do that. And I'd like to start with this first one of Parker in 1939 in the bedroom of the Hildebolt Weber House in Bel Air. And this is obviously a self-portrait, and I think is one of my favorites because I think it says, I have arrived, I've finally arrived as a professional photographer. By this point in 1939, he'd been in Los Angeles a little more than a decade. He was born in Vermont. He walked out here with a friend in 1923, hitchhiked out here with a friend in 1923. That gives you a sense of his kind of can-do spirit. And between 1923 and 1929, he was back and forth on the East Coast, but he started working for the architectural firm of Mott Studios, and that's really where he got his primary architectural photography chops, as it were. He starts entering and winning contests, and then he goes on and hangs out his own shingle in 39. And this is his second major commission. This is a James Dolina house. And really, Parker began his work not in mid-century modern style, but in the homes of celebrities and people associated with the entertainment industry. This is the Joan Bennett home. And in 1939, it's a Wallace Neff house. And I think this is where you can really see, and we'll see this a little bit later, where Parker's style really emerges. It is a home. It looks like it could be a soundstage. You've got the roaring fire. You've got incredibly bright floodlights beaming out all over the place, and dark shadows and fanned out magazines. It's a very suggestive kind of photograph. And this is what he will use to great effect in more humble dwellings as he moves on. Now, in 1940, he meets a very powerful editor, Elizabeth Gordon, who you see here at the Farmer's Market in 1942.
It's a hat she's wearing.
Yes, that is a hat she's wearing. And she's got her obligatory basket there for her vegetables, I guess. But she starts out as an editor at Good Housekeeping, and then convinces William Hearst, who owns House Beautiful, that she's the woman to turn that magazine around. It was a very dowdy magazine at the time. And this is right as she's coming out to California and just falling in love with it. And she and Parker meet, and it's a real meeting of aesthetic sensibilities. And Gordon is really the single most important contact for Parker and really sets the course of his professional career. And one of the reasons is because, as editor of House Beautiful, she needs a photographer who kind of understands this California dream. And Parker not only lives in California, he lives the dream. This is his house, which he built himself. It still stands. It's in Echo Park on Lemoyne Street. And this is his daughter in the foreground, playing with some puppies. It's a model at the front door. That's not his wife. But he used his house and his children and his contacts to amazing effect. And Parker and Gordon saw that this was an important relationship, and she nurtured it. And this is the kind of thing that Parker then moves into, this sun-kissed brand of photography. And it's coming to fruition just as the Shelter magazine presses are really taking off. So you see here is a very iconic Parker view, the sparkling swimming pool, looking out through the plate glass window. This is Pacific Palisades in 1942. And this couple sitting here are the Mosses. Mr. Moss was an interior decorator, and Parker had many, many clients who were decorators. Parker also was key to help Elizabeth Gordon promote this agenda of just better and more gracious living. And this is he became well known for his table settings. And you see here, this is a table setting in a pace setter home, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. But I love this because you've got the jade Snow Wong plates. She's an artisan. And then you've got the obligatory cup of cigarettes. That's what those are there, with the ashtray. So this is all very suave and modern. And Parker did a great job with these. Now, Elizabeth Gordon really felt that it was part of her agenda to teach people how to live well and to teach them good taste. And these are the kinds of things that she puts in her magazine. And then I'm going to just end with a photograph of Lakewood. These are not real people, but in the sense that they're not a real family, I should say. But this is... they're not cutouts, right? But these are models who Parker brought to the shoot, and he became a great favorite. And this is a house that was designed by Chris Choate with Cliff May, and Cliff May and Parker had a very important relationship as well, which we'll talk about a little bit more. But this is very much the kind of thing that Parker excelled at doing, was really selling this kind of leisure-based indoor-outdoor California dream.
Exactly. Jenny mentioned Elizabeth Gordon and her role in Maynard L. Parker's life, and we'll get to that in greater detail in a few minutes, but I thought I'd ask Christopher to tell us what he sees in these Parker photographs from the perspective of an architectural historian. I was sort of wondering, Christopher, what sort of life was Parker helping readers of Sunset and Better Homes and Gardens and House Beautiful to imagine in these houses?
Well, I think it really had to do with time and place, and that's what I want to talk about in this selection of images. The chapter that I contributed to the book was on gardens that Parker photographed, and it was about his collaboration with the landscape architect Tommy Church, and I'll talk a little bit about that toward the end of this collection of images. But I thought I would try to situate Parker's work a little bit more broadly. In Southern California and the West Coast, and also in this period of time, the years right after World War II, post-war architecture and post-war culture with the democratization of home ownership and the growth of suburbia that's happening, but also the growth of anxieties about the Cold War, about the atomic age, about also about conspicuous consumption, about keeping up with the Joneses. I think all of those things are happening in these photographs. And I start with this one along those lines. This is the cover image of the book, and I show it to give a sense both about the kind of approachable domestic life and approachable brand of modernism that Elizabeth Gordon at House Beautiful was promoting with Parker's help, of course, but also that, so you have the white picket fence, you have a woman out clipping roses, but you also have a sense that you're right at the edge of the continent here, and that you can almost imagine that there's a really steep drop off on the side of the cliff, as it were, that you can't see just to the left of that figure. So the sense of and all that is combined in a number of Parker photographs, the sense of promoting a really approachable kind of domestic life, an achievable kind of domestic life that is also situated right here on the edge of the continent on the West Coast, in Los Angeles, but also up and down the West Coast. And even out to Hawaii, speaking of the edge, this is the dining room of the Royal Hawaiian Hotel in Honolulu, which had just been redesigned by Gardner Daly in 1947 when this picture was taken by Parker. And this suggests... I love this picture because it all of these tables waiting for the tourist horde sort of suggests the coming of this abundance and the kind of anticipation of new wealth and new consumption. And also these tables remind me of the way that houses are lined up in a new subdivision, or even the way that airplanes are kind of lined up waiting to land at an airport. But you also get this sense, once you look out through the windows, of course, of this landscape and this sense of being... being out far removed, say, from the city like New York, where the magazine is being produced, and this is also, speaking of those anxieties, this is just 6 years after Pearl Harbor. It's just a couple of years after the end of the war, and along with those anxieties were certain pressures about that kind of consumption that I mentioned. If, I don't know if you can read this at the bottom, it says, "This must be the Christmas they'll never forget." and that is Eve Arden, the actress Eve Arden on the left, with a child who is a model, not her own child. And I want to quote what Sam Waters in his chapter wrote about this image. He writes, "Eve Arden, on an imagined Christmas morning, sits in a blue dressing gown, which is not her own, engaging a child who is not her own, in front of an artificial tree curiously staged in a gingham-themed bedroom." So a kind of perfect encapsulation of this new wealth consumption, also kind of some of the pressures that go with it. This must be the Christmas they'll never forget. And another thing that was happening with Parker's photographs and in Gordon's promotion of a certain kind of modernism was an emphasis on regional modernism, on a West Coast brand of modern architecture that was really distinct from, let's say, European or international style modernism, with which Gordon, beginning in the 1940s, begins to set her magazine in opposition to, and then by the 50s begins really actively railing against. She publishes an infamous editorial attacking the international style in 1953, is that right? That really sums up what a lot of these pictures are leading to in a way, and suggests that European modernism is about the collective, a euphemism, of course, for communism. It's about the group. It doesn't recognize the individual and individual development and opportunity the way that American modernism, and in particular West Coast and California modernism, does. So this picture of John Yeon's house, the architect in Portland, the house that he designed for himself just after the war, I think it's 1946, and house he designed for himself when he was, I think, just in his middle 30s, really a kind of epitome of this idea of regional modernism, of approachable modernism with this wood living room instead of the glass that you might expect to find in Gropius-style modernism, let's say. And if you, you know, I'm sure we'll talk a little bit about the relationship and the differences between Maynard Parker and Julia Shulman. This is an interesting image, I think, to begin thinking about those differences. If you, you know, if you change the materials and kept the architectural forms in this photograph, you could probably pretty quickly have a Julia Shulman photograph if you swap that wood for floor-to-ceiling glass. And in fact, ironically enough, this image, this living room looks a lot like Julia Shulman's own living room in a house that he had commissioned by Rafael Soriano here in Los Angeles, but a much different kind of material finish. This is one of my favorite photographs in the book. This is Cliff May's own pantry, shot by Parker, not just to suggest the abundance that we've been talking about of the post-war years, but also the sense, I think, that the Americans were stocking up, maybe, or thinking about stocking up to prepare for emergencies, atomic and otherwise. And I think the content of the photograph really suggests that abundance, of course, and the lighting really suggests that anxiety more than anything. It's shot almost like a house in a horror film would be shot with this dramatic lighting from below, and the most dramatic shadows, save for the row of liquor bottles that are up on the top, top of the shelf for that day when the world begins to end.
Not prepared for an earthquake, however.
No, certainly not. Different kind of emergency. This is also a Cliff May house in Portola Valley, this house of Bill Lane Jr., who was the ad director at Sunset and also the son of the publisher of that magazine. And I picked this image to show kind of an extreme example, perhaps, of the various arranged marriages that Gordon was trying to establish in the magazine. So between the modern and the rustic, between the past and the present, in this case, you have both a kind of ranch house vernacular architecture and this floor-to-ceiling glass, and of course a fireplace, which is itself has a glass back to it, so a see-through fireplace. So bringing together all of these things, this image I think captures that as well as any other. Also, inside and outside, of course, house and garden are also combined in an image like this. That's made even more explicit in another photograph of a Cliff May house. This one from the late 50s in Rancho Mirage, with a garden landscape architecture by Tommy Church. And I mentioned the chapter that I contributed was on these Tommy Church gardens and the way that Parker photographed them for the magazine. This sense of flow from inside to out, this sense of capturing views from inside the house of a completely private realm in the backyard. So going from the fire pit to the swimming pool to a kind of greener, more wild landscape at the perimeter of the image.
Is that your last one?
That's it.
Well, Parker's photographs, as you've seen in both Jenny's and Christopher's presentations, are quite beautiful. The houses he photographed are, among other things, very welcoming, informal, and I would say homelike. You know, I look at Parker's photographs and of these houses, and I naively call those houses modern. But as you alluded to a moment ago, the architects and critics of the time objected that they weren't modern, that they were sentimental, that they were in effect very large and romantic cottages. So for both of you, Jenny and Christopher, what were the controversies in the architecture of post-war America that Parker's photographs participate in? What were the controversies?
Well, I think the one that Christopher alluded to earlier is that Elizabeth Gordon is really pushing back against this European style of modernism and really trying to stake her claim in an American style that's homegrown. And she works very, very hard in the magazine to raise up architects who she feels live within this world of regionalism and that really seem to her, and she explains this to her readers, very American. And Chris could speak more about kind of the roots of this. But
yes. I think what's going on is not just political in terms of Gordon's own feelings about Europe and all of the kind of Cold War anxieties that I talked about in the coming of McCarthyism and in the 1950s. All of that is being played out to a greater or lesser extent in these pictures. But also in economic terms, that the kind of lifestyle that's being sold or promoted in these pictures is meant to be accessible. It's meant to be in a kind of achievable modernism in the sense that there's a real sense of upward mobility being suggested in the pictures, and of course that perfectly matches the way that the culture was feeling right after the war, the sense that you could own a house for the first time. There's this great democratization of home ownership that happens with the GI Bill and other changes. So all of those things are swirling in these photographs. But at the core, I think, is the distinction that I talked about between a more austere kind of European modernism and an idea that this modernism on the West Coast was more rooted in place, more rooted in tradition even. You talked about nostalgia, and there is a kind of connection to history in place, and even vernacular architecture that would have been anathema to a kind of purist European modern architect or critic at that time. And so Gordon is arguing for an American style, both to promote a group of architects, William Worcester and Harris and Harwell Hamilton Harris and Cliff May, of course, but also to set that against another idea of either what's seen as a kind of more perfect modernism in New York or in European capitals.
Why is it that Frank Lloyd Wright gets enlisted on both sides of that argument? Why is he a person embraced by Gordon at the end of his career and lauded by Gropius and others of the international style at almost at the same time?
Well, I don't know if he was really. I mean, he was left out of the of the 32 show.
Yeah,
I
yes.
mean, he always felt that he wasn't given that due by the East Coast and European establishment, and I think nursed that grudge for a long time. So I think it was really not, I mean, Frank Lloyd Wright starts showing up in House Beautiful in the 40s, but it's really not until the 50s that, you know, she, I think, dedicates an entire issue to his work. And there's a part of a rediscovery of older work, and this happens with Parker's photographs of green and greenhouses as well. Parker is photographing houses in Pasadena, of course, that are 40 years old by the time he's shooting them for House Beautiful. So there's also an effort to reach back to the early Frank Lloyd Wright houses and to the Craftsman houses of Green and Green and others as a way to establish this kind of lineage that leads to a more homegrown modernism, instead of saying, as Philip Johnson and Hitchcock do in the MoMA show of 1932, that this story begins somewhere off in Europe. Gordon's arguing that it's in fact starts right here in Southern California.
So Gordon is attempting to create a parallel tradition that gives modernism its roots in Frank Lloyd Wright's experiences and in the Southern California environment.
But I also think there's an agenda of uplift here for the magazine. I mean, to take it out of the realm of simply a woman's magazine and make it a serious, sort of architectural lifestyle magazine. So someone like Frank Lloyd Wright gives it the gravitas that a magazine would need. She wants to set it apart from magazines like American Home or Good Housekeeping, for that matter. And so she really is very clear, and you can read this in the archive, that she looks everywhere for context to Frank Lloyd Wright, and she figures out that I think Harwell Hamilton Harris and his wife, Jean Murray Banks, is the closest contact she can find, and she works that contact until she can really win him over in 46 when she goes to Taliesin, and then she continues to court him. And you're right, in 54 she devotes an entire issue to him, and it's a very, very symbiotic relationship.
And she's always, Elizabeth Gordon is always walking that line in the magazine between a kind of domesticity that will appeal to readers, that will seem not too off-putting, that will seem close enough to their lives, but just enough out of reach that there is that kind of aspirational movement, that the things seem fresh enough, new enough, just unusual enough to seem like something the readers have to pay attention to. So she's always walking that line, and Parker is really key in that effort for
her. Well, that raises the question, Parker wasn't just a neutral camera eye taking pictures for hire, was he?
Right.
Didn't he have his own point of view, or was he just carrying out an aesthetic agenda set for him by Elizabeth Gordon?
Well, no, I think that he had started developing this eye early on with the celebrity clients and particularly some of the architects and decorators that worked for kind of the high-end movie industry. And as I showed in that second picture, I mean, he was really working with this sense of, and you'll see many of the photographs in the book don't have people in them. And he was having to kind of set the tone of the photograph as if you could step into that and live that life and enjoy those things and really embody that lifestyle. And I think that was what Gordon saw as very simpatico. So he did this in a variety of ways. He did this with very intense staging, with lighting, very dramatic lighting. He did it with elevation. He stood up on ladders and couches and made things look very big and spacious that were actually very tiny. And so he was working with this kind of aspirational ideal that you were talking about, and that was what Gordon was doing as well.
And also what Jenny said earlier, I think, is really right, that it's a kind of meeting of the minds, a meeting of sensibilities. And so they're each using the other to an extent, and they're each very open about that fact and the possibilities that each saw in the other as a way to advance his or her career. And in fact, Parker meets, just before meeting her, I think he changes the name of his office to Modern Photography.
Yes, right?
So even he is kind of poised, even before the war has begun, thinking about, almost anticipating this kind of post-war American culture and thinking about a kind of modernism and a kind of not just beginning to photograph architecture much more than he had, but also thinking about what modern architecture might mean and how that might fit into the body of work that he had been establishing up to that. So he's about, he's born in 1900, so he's 40 years old when he makes that shift. He's looking ahead to those years when he'll have this productive partnership with Gordon.
And we're talking about Elizabeth Gordon because he's something of a lightning rod figure, but Parker worked for everybody,
right.
Every publication.
Yes. So he did, and that's a great point. So one of his principal clients was House Beautiful, but he worked for many shelter magazines. I mentioned American Home, Sunset, Better Homes and Gardens, Country Life in America. So he really went from kind of the high end. Country Life in America would be, I don't know what equivalent to Architectural Digest today, I guess. And that's also, he did do a lot of work for Architectural Digest. Down to Good Housekeeping. And some of these magazines, which I thought was astonishing when we started working on the book, even as early as 1940, were in the millions of readers. I mean, it's not like it's a small readership. Now, Gordon, her readership was, when she took over in 41, was about 220,000 or something subscribers, which would be equivalent to Better Homes and Gardens. So she was also very keen to, and she was a crackerjack marketer, she was very keen to up the circulation.
By the way, maybe at this point it might be worth asking you, how did this collection of Parker materials come to the Huntington? Can you tell us a little bit about that and give us a bit more background?
Yes, I'd be happy to do that. So this is, I guess, one of the great things about being at an institution forever. In 1995, when I was working there, we got a call from the family, Parker's family, who still lived in that home in Echo Park that you saw on the cover of the House Beautiful. And Parker died in 1976, and the archive, what was his studio, sat in the home pretty much untouched until 1995 when we went to go look at it. And I think the family was struggling to know what to do with it because they were being found by people that wanted to use the images, and they weren't really sure how to manage that. And in fact, I think one of Parker's granddaughter is in the audience today. I hope she'll wave. Oh, there she is. Dee Carowin is so. Who was extremely helpful to the book and is an architect. So there you go. The apple doesn't fall far from the tree. But the family had us come over and look at the archive or the studio, and we brought it back to the Huntington in 1995. We were driving a wood-paneled station wagon, fittingly enough. So I had to make several trips, and I didn't know what I was hauling back, and we got it back, and it frankly languished because it was so large, 60,000 images, very idiosyncratically arranged because he knew his own arrangement, Parker knew his own arrangement. So it wasn't until, I think, 2007, we got a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities, third try's a charm. We got it, and we were able to then finally organize it and manage it, and we hired a team of archivists.
Christopher, you wrote a fascinating chapter on landscaping and gardening, of what Elizabeth Gordon took to calling the station wagon way of life. And you wrote that the garden, to quote you, provided an ideal stage for Gordon to present her message of homegrown modernism. So when we look at Parker's photograph, what do we see as modern about that landscape?
Well, so many of those pictures, as I mentioned, were gardens by Tommy Church. So there was a really productive collaboration at the magazine at House Beautiful. And I was looking at the period from about 48 till about 56, which was the period when Joseph Howland was the garden editor there. And they had, it's such a different world, not just the circulation numbers that Jenny mentioned, but the resources that they had to work with a figure like Tommy Church, who was at that point far and away the best known landscape architect in the country, if not the world. And he was working on a regular basis with the magazine. So Howland would commission or write himself pieces on gardens, almost always by Tommy Church, and Parker would go out and photograph them. So the three men had a very close relationship and a very productive collaboration. And it suggested, I think, the kind of modernism that Gordon was interested in particularly well, because it was immediately tied to place, of course, and it immediately was, just because of the differences between a garden and a house, even with a modern landscape architect like Tommy Church, or at that point in his career, he had a very varied career, but at that point he was really doing modernist gardens. A garden is more approachable. It's not the kind of hermetic box that an international style house is. And so just because of the differences between garden and architecture, between landscape architecture and architecture, you have a more approachable kind of modernism to begin with. And then the way Parker photographed those gardens, I was looking at what they called the big terrace garden, which was these kind of big sweeping backyard forms that most of you will be familiar with from the backyards of that era, often framing a swimming pool, but not always. And that produced a really kind of legible form that played extremely well in the magazine, these big, broad, sweeping curves that at once recalled, really high art, modern art precedents on the one hand, like Miró or Arp, Noguchi, but also suggested the way that you could turn your backyard in a new subdivision in Southern California into an instantly usable space and really take advantage of all this extra square footage. So again, it was this line that Gordon was walking and using these three men to help her walk between a kind of message that really had its roots in high art modernism, but also was about kind of achievable domestic and stylish life that her readers could begin to move into, or at least dream about and aspire to.
Well, let's talk for a moment or two about the domestication of style. Jenny, at one point in the book, you comment on Parker's photographs saying that they offered a seductive vision of a private world filled with things. So perhaps you could talk about some of the domestic relationships you see in Parker's photographs. What's going on there?
Well, I think, you know, the other thing that we haven't mentioned here, just the commercial aspect of what Parker was doing for Gordon, was she was very beholden to advertisers to make her magazine go. And so one of the things that Parker excelled at was photographs of appliances and hi-fis and all the kind of things, the modern toys that people would want, dishwashers, cars and carports, as we said, barbecues, and it was really all the latest. There's a really wonderful photograph in the book that you'll see of the first post-war house. It's called the post-war house, of a bed which has these armrests that come down, and it's like a control panel is on it. It's you can kind of sort of control the entire house right from the armrests of your bed. And Parker would do many, many close-ups of that kind of thing. And so there was a sense in which he was working with her to kind of create this aspirational ideal that we talked about, of that maybe you wouldn't be able to afford all of these things right now, but it's something to aspire to in the future, and he's going to show you the panoply of goods that would be available to you.
And it's, I think it's probably worth talking a little bit more about the post-war house, because it's such a, in some ways, it's such an ideal example of what Gordon was using the magazine to do and what Parker was photographing. So the post-war house is on Wilshire Boulevard and Highland. It's a kind of model home for, dreamt up by Fritz Burns, the developer, who was at that point doing a lot of subdivisions in the San Fernando Valley and elsewhere, hired Welton Beckett and Werdemann to design this house, and House Beautiful gave it a 40-page spread in the magazine in 1946 when it was brand new. And it really was much more, in that case in particular, the photographs are much less about the architecture and much more about this house as a prototype for a new kind of suburban living and a kind of container for all of these products that are almost being stuffed in every available inch. Mm-hmm. And that house is still standing, by the way. It's now, it went briefly into foreclosure a few years ago, and now it's there's a kind of after school or tutoring program. I was just poking around there a few weeks ago, actually. But at the time, it was this perfect vehicle for selling both these kinds of dreams about a new kind of living and the actual products that Gordon had struck deals to promote in the magazine.
Well, so far we've been sort of located in a particular time and place, Cold War, immediate post-war period, conflicts between an American-style modernism and an international-style modernism, uncertainties about what the future will hold, but aspirational and acquiring things. But the question I suppose might be asked now is these houses, the houses designed by Cliff May or Harris or others, do they have anything to inform today's architects? Or are these houses just nostalgic stuff to be collected by mid-century style collectors? Are these houses that we've seen in these photographs informing us about domestic relations or houses that we should live in today?
I would say absolutely, for a whole number of reasons, starting with the fact that if you pick up a magazine like Dwell, you see the legacy of Parker very clearly in those pages, and given the interest in mid-century modernism and a kind of neo-modernism in the last decade or so, I think these questions are really relevant. Also, there's a debate going on now, post-crash, post-2008, about the size of the typical house and whether we would learn the lessons of that crash and learn how to live in smaller spaces. I don't know that. I think for a while it was looking that way, and now I think the typical house is again expanding. But it's also connected to the questions, just not just in architecture, but cultural questions about, you know, you look at the post-war house, you look at this kind of idealization of the suburban detached single-family house, and there are all kinds of cultural, political implications you can draw from that. sprawl and all of the problems that come with it, the connection to car culture that is implicit in these photographs. Also, we haven't talked at all. There are some good chapters in the book about the kind of exclusion that's tied mm-hmm. into this and, right. and the kind of homogeneity that you're seeing in the pictures. I think all of that has to be brought into the discussion. But in terms of kind of the contemporary debate, there's still a debate when you talk about the mortgage deduction, which is very much on the table in Washington, the sense of the whether the single family house deserves to still have that central place in the culture and whether as a result of putting it there, we need to continue to subsidize it. I mean, I think those are really continue to be relevant debates.
Yeah, and I think also this idea of kind of it sets the tone, sets the course, this idea of privacy, turning away from the street, this kind of idea of home as sanctuary. Should it continue to be that? I mean, when you look at these photographs and you see how much is turned away from the community into the backyard, the private backyard, the swing sets, the playgrounds, the swimming pools. I think that's, to me, was very kind of sobering, I think, to realize that this is kind of where, not it doesn't start here, but it kind of explodes here in a way
right.
that we're living the legacy of now.
And that was really one of the questions I tried to explore at the end of my chapter, whether this emphasis on privacy really begins to chip away at an idea of the civic realm or a kind of collective idea of how the city, a city like Los Angeles, ought to be organized. And we're in the midst of in terms of ongoing debates, this is a city that's still really park poor. We're trying to figure out how to squeeze new park space, particularly in communities that haven't had access to it, into a really built out urban landscape. And you can go back to these pictures and see that, you know, beginning in the 40s, it goes back earlier, but really accelerating in the 40s and 50s, this idea that instead of having a central park here in Los Angeles, we would have a million central parks, a miniature one in every backyard. Mm-hmm. And that you would have all these references in these spreads to the number of amenities that you could pack into your backyard. So all the things that you used to look to the greater city to provide, open space, leisure space, you could pack into your suburban very small backyard, and except for making a trip out in your station wagon to buy all the stuff to pack into your house, you wouldn't have to go out to experience any of those things. And there are real implications for that in terms of how we think about community, how we think about public space, how we think about public architecture in a city like Los Angeles.
And I'm just curious, Don, I want to ask you a question. I want to turn that question back on you as someone who's lived in Lakewood for your whole life, and when you look at these kinds of photographs, I mean, certainly there must be a sense of nostalgia. But what do you see when you see those and these kind of?
I'm afraid I've drunk the Kool-Aid. although I do not live in a house that anyone would call modern, although it is an undecorated shed, very much an undecorated shed. When I see the photographs of these sumptuous houses, these suave houses that Parker photographed, I immediately understand how I might project my life into them. I think the genius of Parker's work with Gordon and others was that he was able to create photographs that invited you to project your hopes, dreams, aspirations, life into the photographs. And they still work their magic on me. I'm a sucker for these glorious photographs. Although I must admit, in my own imagination, I think of myself living in a post and beam Pierre Koenig sort of house. Right. But boy, these beguile, these seduce, and the photographs do exactly what they were supposed
right.
to do.
Mm-hmm. And they seduce in a really different way than a Shulman photograph, say.
Indeed.
I mean that's yeah. You know, if you think about the Shulman photographs of the Pierre Koenig houses, were much more glamorous. These are not particularly glamorous photographs always, with the exception of maybe the Hollywood stuff.
Right.
The domestic pictures and the suburban pictures are not glamorous in the same way. There's a way that those Shulman photographs float entirely free of any kind of context.
Yes.
And that's part of their great appeal, of course. That's part of their sexiness. And their glamour, and there's a different kind of appeal in the Parker photographs, which does allow you, I think you're right, to project mm-hmm. yourself and your own life and your immediate future. It's easy to look at those, you know, a Shulman picture of a Craig Elwood house and imagine what it would be like to live that kind of life, but it seems much more distant than the kind of life that you can imagine in many of the Parker pictures.
Well, yes.
No, so I was going to say that, and Gordon was very clear that she wanted people to bring their own individuality. I mean, she felt that people didn't really know what good taste was, and she was going to teach them. And she's very obvious about that. She says at the end of her career, in a kind of candid moment, "I used House Beautiful as a propaganda and teaching tool for people's thinking and wanting apparatus." And so that was her real goal. But she, in these photographs, wants all these kinds of fabrics and textures and tchotchkes and flower arrangements to be kind of a sense of one's interior space, too. It's supposed to show what a person can do and how they can live in a kind of lavish way.
And that campaign, in the broadest sense, was much more successful than, let's say, the arts and architecture campaign with the case study houses.
Right.
Those houses were also meant to be prototypes. They almost all ended up being one-offs, very difficult to reproduce for a whole number of reasons, whereas the Cliff May ranch house basically took over the entire country by the time the 50s were up. So in that sense, it was a more successful, it was a winning campaign in a way that the arts and architecture one wasn't.
We have just
for better and worse, I should say.
We have just a bit more time before we go to audience questions. Would you like to give them the opportunity to join in the conversation? Jenny, briefly, could you just give us a précis of the other chapters in the book? What are the subjects that this... It's not just beautiful photographs, folks. It's got some good writing in it.
Sure, yes. So when I decided to do this book on Parker, I knew that I didn't have the subject specialty to take on the entire swath of his career. And I was very clear that as the first book on Parker, it needed to sort of set the tone. It needed to give his biography, of course, but it also needed to set him within the context in which he worked. And so one of the great pleasures of working at the Huntington, being a collections-based research institution, is that we have amazing people, writers, coming through all the time. So the Haynes Foundation very nicely gave me a grant to invite what was my dream team of authors, two of which are sitting here. So this was the first draft picks. Everyone said yes, and that was fantastic. And so as was introduced, Don wrote an incredible introduction about searching for home and meaning in post-war suburbia. Sam Waters wrote the first chapter about the celebrity residences having to do with Parker's beginning career. And Edward Bosley wrote a really wonderful chapter on the Green and Green, the regional architects that Gordon enlisted, including Green and Green, Harwell Hamilton Harris, and of course, most memorably, Frank Lloyd Wright. Elaine Tyler May, a noted professor of American Studies, wrote about this kind of Cold War period of anxieties and gender issues. Monica Pennock wrote a very interesting essay on the influential Pace Setter program. We didn't get into the whole Pace Setter, but that was a program that Gordon instituted in 48 and ran till the end of her tenure in 64. Dan Gregory, who I'm sure many of you know in this audience, wrote about this very symbiotic relationship between Cliff May and Maynard Parker. They were professional colleagues in the sense that Parker really, really helped May promote his photography. Was very helpful, his architecture very helpful in getting May's architecture published in many, many magazines. And then Christopher, as he mentioned, about this kind of triumvirate of Joseph Howland, the garden editor, Tommy Church, and Maynard Parker. And then finally, last but definitely not least, we've got a wonderful photo essay by Charles Phoenix on using some of the home movies that Parker took, using stills from those home movies to explore Parker's passion for cross-country travel and cars.
His Jeepster,
yes. And so that's in the center of the book.
Well, we're going to remind you that you can buy copies of the Maynard O. Parker book in the lobby after our conversation this evening, and we're going to stay around and do some signing if that's something you'd like to do. But I think now let's bring up the lights a bit, and we'll take some questions from our audience. We do please ask you to wait for the microphone to reach you so that everyone can hear your questions and it can be put on tape. So do we have a question down here in front?
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Wonderful talk.
My question is about race in Los Angeles, such an important topic. And I was wondering, since Parker was active during the civil rights movement, can you maybe talk about if you see anything of that in the photographs?
Well, I think the short answer is no. I mean, in the sense that he's really showing the kind of aspirational middle-class white ideal of suburbia. And so what's very striking, when there are people in these photographs, they're all Caucasian people. And I think that has to do, I'm sure either Don or Chris can talk about kind of the demographic of who was owning homes and who the magazines were actually being pitched to and whatnot. But that's, it's conspicuous by its absence.
Right, exactly.
Right, right. Yeah. I think you always have to look at the pictures and think, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, who's being left out, who and what is being excluded and why. And we didn't talk about it too much tonight, but I think the book really does begin to touch on those issues and the gender issues that that Jenny mentioned. So I would say that he's not addressing those issues at all. And the question is then, why not and how is he alighting those things, leaving them out?
Mm-hmm. And this is by no means a defense, but it's worth bearing in mind, however, in the midst of that enormous exclusion, both culturally and to a certain extent legally during the period, that Shelter magazines and the most popular ones did reach down into a white working class and attempted to match the aspirations or hopes of the white working class for a better life in suburban places. And that was, for what it was, that too was an achievement.
No, go ahead.
Another question. Someone? In the back.
I'm just wondering if you're seeing any turning back towards an emphasis on public space and public consumption, kind of the opposite of what's expressed in these photographs. Is there an intellectual and aesthetic movement at works now that's going to head back in a public direction?
I would say absolutely, and in fact that's a real focus of my work at the LA Times, is that what I see is a kind of emerging public turn in Los Angeles, in Southern California, in a region that was so deeply privatized for so many decades, that the city is, by investing in transit, investing in park space and open space in a way that it hasn't in many decades, and thinking about pedestrian access and thinking about bike culture as opposed to car culture. I think there's a real change beginning to happen and beginning to make itself felt in a city that is in some ways having to relearn the art of public architecture, public realm design. So I see all kinds of evidence that shift is happening here, absolutely.
More questions?
Because the nature of these photographs is basically editorial or commercial, how much of the image itself was created in the darkroom, or the impact of the image?
That's an interesting question.
Good question.
Do you mean, so in other words, how much was he manipulating the prints? Okay. Well, I mean, that's a great question. I mean, what we got when we got the archive was almost entirely negatives and transparencies. We do have some finished prints. He was doing a lot of manipulation. One of the things he had to do is his negatives were very thin because he had to use these for a lot of different reasons. So he might take an image of a bedroom that he used for a fine quality print for a client. He might have to run it in a newspaper, and he might have to run it in a Shelter magazine. So he did a lot of dodging and burning. And for those of you who know what old school darkroom work was, But I don't see a lot of masking or that kind of thing. But we don't have a lot of examples, honestly.
He did a lot of pre-manipulation by creating lighting effects.
Yes, right.
In advance, and knowing where light would fall and where shadow would pool, so that he didn't have to, it seems to me from what I've seen, didn't have to do that much more work mm-hmm. for many of the images in the dark room.
Right.
And Sam Waters, in fact, in his chapter talks quite a bit about not only how Parker was photographing Hollywood stars, but how he was bringing strategies from stage design, set design, movie lighting, and mm-hmm. bringing them into architectural photography in some ways that really paid great dividends for him.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Another question.
Can you tell us a little bit more about his relationship with Shulman? Were they rivals?
Ah. Well, both Shulman and Parker were journeyman photographers taking pretty much the same kind of pictures all over Southern California.
Right.
If you look at Shulman's whole body of work, he's taking pictures of gas stations and grocery stores, and so is Parker. They diverged in terms of who their principal clients were. Shulman had his core clients, and right. Parker had his mm-hmm. core clients.
But they certainly appeared in the same magazines quite often, and we've talked a lot about the differences, but I think the chief similarity is that they were both salesmen, they were both hustling to sell a product, and they were very upfront about that. And in fact, some of their best pictures, their most artistic pictures even, are the ones when they're doing that, you know, mm-hmm. when the sales job is the heaviest and they're most aware of that. So they were both very willing to say, I'm a photographer for hire, I'm not an artist. That's what Shulman said all the time, but I think Parker had the same attitude. Mm-hmm.
The difference perhaps most striking to me is from an outside perspective is that Parker begins to wind up his career in the late 1960s, and then his material sort of lay quiet after his death, whereas Julius Shulman lives on and on.
Right.
In a wonderful way. I don't mean to be critical.
No, long enough to be rediscovered.
And to reinvent himself to some degree.
And to mm-hmm. curate his own reputation yeah. so right. that we, right. understand, we understand.
Right, and that's why I think this book is important, because Shulman, of course, not only lives so long and is so productive late into his life and is curating his own legend, he's also lives long enough to see a revival of interest in the architecture that he was photographing when it was brand new.
Yeah.
Right. So
right.
the cycles of taste turn, and he's still working when modernism is rediscovered mm-hmm. and mid-century becomes cool again, in a way that Parker, of course, never had the opportunity to do. So it's left to this kind of posthumous study to do some of that work, whereas Shulman was actively doing that himself.
Another question down here?
Is this on now?
Yes.
Yeah, I migrated out here in 1969. Now, maybe that was at the end of Maynard Parker's influence, yeah. but the big factor in garden and home design that I recall is Sunset Magazine.
Indeed.
Would you talk about the relationships between the styles that we're seeing in this book and Sunset Magazine?
Well, Sunset Magazine is a big client of Parker's, primarily because of Cliff May.
Cliff May, precisely.
It's very interesting to read through the Cliff May archive and see how they're using Parker and May to go in and photograph things. And to Parker may have gone in initially with May to photograph a house, and then the editor will come back and say, well, that's great, but you need to take out more furniture, you need to put in more furniture, you need to get this angle or that angle. So Sunset was a big client, and Parker and especially May were being promoted heavily in that magazine.
And Dan Gregory's chapter in the book, Dan was an editor at Sunset for many years, talks about the differences between those publications, and also let's not forget the LA Times Home magazine, which was publishing
right.
a lot of these pictures in the 50s and 60s.
Mm-hmm. Buy a copy of the book. We have time for one or two more questions, I suppose.
What is the definition of vernacular architecture?
Ah, vernacular architecture.
Good question. So I'll take that one. So as opposed to... modernism in its purest form really put a premium on not having any references either to historical ornament or to sort of traditional architecture of place. So I'd say vernacular architecture has to do with a kind of more craft tradition that relates a building to its place, to its region, in a way that the international style was keen to banish. So some of what's happening in the work of Cliff May and others is making some references to vernacular architecture safe in a way, acceptable in a way, in the sense that, in a way that they weren't, say, in the earlier decades of modern architecture.
Yeah. I mean, the power of Frank Lloyd Wright and the Green Brothers is to establish a kind of modernism or something new within the context of vernacular architecture.
Right, or to combine novelty and the sense of vernacular place. Yeah.
One last question, right over here.
You spoke briefly about the homogeneity of the images, and you talked about the editor who was trying to teach people about style. Did Parker or Gordon ever talk about the idea of like sort of a velvet rope, that some of the things that they were showing were not attainable, that they were sort of this some of it you could possibly attain, but there was a line where they wanted to show like a higher class or maybe a hierarchy that wasn't attainable?
That's a great question. And I think these editors of the Shelter magazines were very clear who their demographic was, who they were writing for. So oftentimes something would be pitched to Gordon and she would say, that's for American Home, or that's for Good Housekeeping, that's not for us. And of course she knew what that meant, but she also was very clear that there was a kind of luxe house that was too much for House Beautiful. So for instance, Cliff May at the very end of his career brings his Mandalay residence, which is huge. I can't remember, it's like 12,000 square feet or something. And it's kind of the pinnacle of his career, and Gordon has featured him over and over again, and she finally says to him, you know, that's too big. We can't do that in House Beautiful. That's beyond our readership. She's also very clear that what she was showing, you may not be able to afford it now all at once, but you can buy pieces of it. You can think about pieces of it. It's something to look forward to in the future. And so that was also what Parker was very good at doing, kind of isolating aspects that her readers would then want.
I think it's important at this point just to take note that when we talk about consumption in the context of Gordon and Parker's work, that Gordon really thought you should buy stuff and keep it and not buy stuff and throw it away.
Right,
She wanted people to buy things of value, mm-hmm. well-designed,
yes.
carefully designed, craftsman work, and not just a disposable consumption of stuff.
And you can see that in the way the coverage really shifts from the 40s into the 50s. And one of the things that surprised me the most in looking at these copies of House Beautiful at the Huntington, looking at these photographs, is how, you know, we think of the 40s sort of flowing into the 50s and that being all of a piece in terms of how this architecture was being sold. In fact, there's a really significant break by the mid-50s where all of a sudden House Beautiful is talking about repainting your house, not buying a new house, but what to do with the house that's maybe beginning to show some signs of age, how to make these things that you've bought last longer. And there's also a shift that comes with the arrival of air conditioning and the way that that's bringing people back inside the house, particularly outside of California. People that had tried the ranch-style house and the kind of indoor-outdoor flow in New York State said, when air conditioning comes along, you know, they're back inside. And, of course, the rise of television is also bringing people in by the middle of the 50s really back inside the house. So the magazine is responding to those shifts. But one of the ones that surprised me the most is that sense of making things last and not dealing with an entire brand new universe. And by 1954, 1955, it's much more about dealing with what you already have.
And in fact, interestingly, when Gordon leaves the magazine in 1964, which is a huge long term for a magazine editor, the idea that I've heard is that she was really feeling that what the Hearst Corporation was asking her to use in terms of advertising, the products that she was being forced to advertise weren't up to her standards. And she felt that there were shoddy manufacturing, shoddy products, and she didn't want to run them in her magazine because she felt that it was breaking this kind of bond with the reader that she'd established.
Well, as you can see, there's a great deal more to talk about in this remarkable book, the writing of Jenny Watts and Christopher Hawthorne and the other authors who are included in it. We strongly recommend it to you, but let's give our conversants a round of applause.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.